Good evening. Biden chooses a running mate and makes history. Trump's executive orders threaten states and Social Security, and the city argues it has no duty to discipline cops. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, August 11th, 2020. President Vladimir Putin Tuesday announced Russia has registered an effective vaccine against the new coronavirus. The Russian drug, administered in two injections with a three-week interval between them, is supposed to provide protection against the coronavirus for up to 2 years. Putin says the vaccination will be voluntary for use by those who so desire. Currently, Russia ranks fourth in the number of coronavirus infections. As of Tuesday morning, the country had reported more than 897,000 COVID-19 cases and 15,000 deaths. Western scientists were critical of Russia's announcement. In Britain, a researcher said such a super-fast approval could mean that potential adverse effects of a vaccine may not be picked up. Another immunologist said collateral damage from deploying any vaccine that is not yet known to be safe and effective would exacerbate our current problems insurmountably. And progressive representative Ilhan Omar is facing strong opposition in today's Minnesota primary. Her challenger, Anton Melton Moe, a black lawyer and mediator, raised millions, 20% by the pro-Israel America PAC. Much of Omar's money has come from labor unions, teachers, and small individual contributions. Omar gained notoriety as a member of the Squad, a group of four progressive women freshmen. Another Squad member, Rashida Tlaib, won a primary challenge in Michigan last week. And New York Squad member Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez also sailed to an easy primary victory. And the Big Ten Conference won't play football this fall because of COVID-19. The conference includes historic programs such as Ohio State, Michigan, Rutgers, and Wisconsin. Players and coaches had tried to keep the games on schedule, but with fear that students may not be coming back to campus next fall, it became clear the medical risks were too much. Also on Tuesday, the shattered city of Beirut marked a week since the catastrophic explosion that killed at least 171 people, injured thousands, and plunged Lebanon into a deeper political crisis. The city observed a minute of silence at 6:08 p.m. local time, the moment on August 4th when more than 2,000 tons of ammonium nitrate exploded in the city's port where it had been stored for more than 6 years, apparently with the knowledge of top political and security officials. The explosion fueled outrage against top political leaders and security agencies and led to the resignation of the government on Monday. It still wasn't clear what caused the fire in a port warehouse triggering the explosion. Joe Biden named California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate moments ago, selecting the first black woman to compete on a major party's presidential ticket, acknowledging the vital role black voters still play in his bid to defeat President Donald Trump. Biden tweeted, "I have the great honor to announce that I've picked Kamala Harris, a fearless fighter for the little guy and one of the country's finest public servants, as my running mate. Together with you, we're going to beat Trump." Harris, a 55-year-old first-term senator, is one of the party's most prominent figures and a top contender for the number two spot after her own White House campaign ended. But Harris's record as California Attorney General and District Attorney in San Francisco was heavily criticized by progressives. Law professor Lara Bazelon is a former director of the Loyola Law School Project for the Innocent.
She says Harris staunchly opposed the release of people who were wrongfully convicted by California.
Her record as San Francisco District Attorney and then later as California's Attorney General was not progressive.
How is Harris not a progressive? What did she do when she was prosecutor that did not fit a progressive mold?
For me, it's her record in wrongful conviction cases where it was really clear that there had been a catastrophic injustice and that someone was likely innocent and locked up. And time again, her office as Attorney General doubled and tripled down on those convictions and did what they could to defend them, even though they were tainted and corrupt. There's also a failure by her to embrace many progressive reforms, including joining calls to pass legislation mandating body-worn camera footage, mandating that her office investigate officer-involved shootings. She laughed when she was asked whether marijuana should be legal. She opposed Kevin Cooper's request for DNA testing. This is a very famous wrongful conviction death penalty case. In many of these instances, she's come around and switched her position, but that only happened once she became a senator in the United States, and some of these positions became untenable.
Is there such a thing as a progressive prosecutor?
Absolutely is such a thing. When you look at people who are progressive prosecutors, what they are doing is they're trying to dismantle the system of mass incarceration. They are opposing cash money bail. They are opposing the prosecution of low-level drug offenses and even in some cases offenses like loitering and prostitution. They are looking toward treatment. They are addressing root causes of crime, including mental illness. They are aggressively going after police officers and officer-involved shooting cases. So we see it all over the country. And in fact, there was just an upset victory in Queens by a young woman who ran as a public defender who had never prosecuted a case. But she's just the latest victor in a series of upset races where voters are really clamoring for change and they are electing agents of change.
How did she get to be such a progressive, you know, get a reputation as a progressive?
Because she called herself that very thing in her book. And so she has a whole chapter where she calls herself a progressive prosecutor. And I think that was what launched this kind of coverage, the coverage that you're describing. And then it also, I think, propelled people like me who are very familiar with her record to correct that and point out what the reality actually is.
What do the defense people think of it? Think of the fact that Kamala Harris is being seen as a progressive? Are they rolling their eyeballs?
I don't want to speak for every criminal defense attorney or activist, but I think it's safe to say that many of us are, yes, rolling our eyes.
And how about her statements on race, the way she confronted Biden?
I think she was saying that she was bust as a person of color to integrate the school system. I didn't hear her say that she had a deprived childhood. She's a very compelling speaker, and she can put together a case in a way that is concise and cogent and interesting.
Lara Bazelon is a law professor and former director of the Loyola Law School Project for the Innocent in Los Angeles.
Biden and Harris will appear together tomorrow, the first time they've been together since a painful debate moment last year when Harris grilled Biden on his opposition to busing, a way to break down segregated school systems. And a federal judge on Tuesday denied a voting rights group's request for an order barring Georgia election officials from requiring voters to pay for their own postage to submit absentee ballots and ballot applications. Black Voters Matter claimed requiring voters to pay for postage to submit their absentee applications is a poll tax outlawed by the 24th Amendment. Although more than 1.2 million Georgians voted in person in the June primary election, a record-breaking 1.1 million voted by mail. Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer blasted the Trump appointee to head the service, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a longtime Trump supporter.
The current issues at the post office alarm every American. The new Postmaster General has instituted policies that have contributed to inexcusable delays in mail delivery. But now, topping the cake, the Postal Service has informed some states they may need to pay a first-class rate to deliver ballots rather than the normal rate, nearly tripling the cost. At a time when people will have to vote by mail in record numbers because they can't or won't go vote in person, the Postmaster General is saying we should triple the rate of cost to vote by mail? What a despicable derogation of democracy. What is his rationale? It's a small amount of money. Ballots are a small percentage of the mail that's delivered. It's to discourage people from voting. He ought to be ashamed of himself to even consider this. Tripling what it costs to vote by mail at a time when more people will vote by mail than ever before. If anyone had any thought that this Postmaster General was on the level, it's now dispensed. To triple the cost of voting by mail would be an outrageous and insidious policy that would make it even harder and more expensive for states already struggling with depleted budgets from COVID-19 to conduct our elections safely. Democrats will fight this policy with every tool at our disposal. If our Republican colleagues care about a free and fair election this November, they should as well.
And that's Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader. Trump is repeatedly charged without evidence that mail-in ballots are riddled with fraud, except in Florida, where Trump supports the practice and where many conservative voters make use of absentee ballots to vote. And Donald Trump announced a series of executive orders on Saturday from his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, in front of a friendly audience of club members. Among the executive orders, meant to break a logjam with Democrats over coronavirus relief, one of the executive orders authorized a $400 a week unemployment insurance payment, less than the $600 that just ran out for millions of Americans. $100 of that would have to come from the states that are already deeply in hock due to the coronavirus. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo had this to say about that on Monday.
Your solution is to cost me another $4 billion? Thank you. That's handing the drowning man an anchor. Hold on to this. Maybe it'll help. No. An anchor does not help a drowning man. So I hope this was just a tactic by the president. But if he thinks this is a resolution, this only makes the bad situation worse. And this is a president who's trying to show leadership because the American people are demanding leadership in the midst of this crisis. And this only sets him back. My advice to the president is when you are in a hole, stop digging. This executive order only digs the hole deeper. It's the last thing the people of this country needed.
And that's Governor Cuomo. Another of Trump's executive orders would halt the payroll tax, which is taken from each person's paycheck, known as FICA, for Federal Insurance Contributions Act. It's really a premium for a government insurance program we all know as Social Security, passed by Congress on August 14, 1935. The president of the Social Security Works Organization is Nancy Altman. She says Trump's order is a thinly veiled attempt to permanently end Social Security by cutting off its funding.
He used the word terminate, which is the right word. He wants to terminate Social Security's dedicated funding. And to translate that, that is killing Social Security. It's a death sentence for Social Security. It's a really radical, and it's consistent with what right-wing ideologues have wanted to do since the very beginning. Dwight Eisenhower, of course, a Republican president who supported Social Security, championed it, and called for its expansion, and in fact oversaw its expansion, once wrote to his brother in a private letter that there are a tiny splinter group who want to end Social Security. But he said, and this is a direct quote, their number is negligible and they are stupid. And it's as I say, he wrote it, I think, in 1954 or 56 to his brother Edgar. And unfortunately, a member of that tiny splinter group is the current occupant of the White House. This is really a radical proposal.
What is the payroll tax and why is that associated with Social Security?
Like with any insurance, you pay the premium and you get the benefit. If you don't pay the premium, it's over. And in fact, what he's saying is, we don't have to pay for this, which means there will be no revenue. It has an accumulated reserve of $2.9 trillion, but it pays out benefits of about $1 trillion a year. So if there's no income coming in, then within 3 years, there will be no money to pay any benefits, and the program will literally cease because by law, it cannot pay any benefits unless it has money to pay all the benefits plus all the administrative costs associated with providing those benefits.
So if Donald Trump was reelected, he has a four-year term, the Social Security would run out after 3 years.
Exactly, 2023. One of two things. He's not up for reelection, so he could say, too bad. I've always hated this program. And in fact, despite his rhetoric when he ran for president and said he was not going to cut it, before running for president, called it a Ponzi scheme, talked about privatizing it, raising the retirement age, or he would keep Social Security hostage because you would hope that overnight you wouldn't just stop paying 65 million people benefits. Two-thirds of seniors rely on Social Security for most of their income, one out of four for virtually all of their income. But he could hold it hostage to force privatizing it, raising the retirement age to 70, means testing it or even higher. The point is that this idea of deferring the collection is really the death sentence, and it's good that he said it. He famously says the quiet part out loud, as people say, and they're now trying to walk it back, saying, oh, he didn't mean permanent, oh, he'll use general revenue, something. But he said out loud the quiet part. He wants to end Social Security, which is what the radical fringe group. This should be a five-alarm fire for anyone who supports Social Security.
One of the reasons that in the past they didn't want to vote against or be against Social Security was that Florida and Arizona are filled with retirees who generally vote more conservatively than the rest of the country. And therefore, this would be a dagger in the heart of Trump's base, wouldn't it?
It would be. And the only thing I can tell you is a couple theories, but they're just theories. One is that he's been inside the White House bubble, and somehow he thinks if he can disguise it and call it a tax, this is a payroll tax. And that's why I really insist on calling it by its name, which is an insurance contribution or a premium for Social Security. Who doesn't like cutting taxes? But that's not what this is. From the very beginning, it is dedicated, can only be used for Social Security. That's why the right wing wants to get rid of it. And I think he was convinced that, oh, he can sell this as a tax cut, not realizing that seniors, it's a bread and butter for them. There's so much noise, and they're beginning to already say, no, it's not what it sounds like and all of that, that it's really important that people, before they vote on November 3rd, particularly older people, people with disabilities, people who have older members of their family who rely on Social Security, people who hope to get old at some point, that everyone who has been contributing to Social Security knows that Donald Trump is reelected, you can kiss Social Security goodbye. That should be a wake-up call for everyone. This is nothing fake about this. This is coming out of his words. He used the word terminate, and he wants to terminate or kill Social Security.
Nancy Altman is president of Social Security Works. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. On Monday, Manhattan Supreme Court Justice Joan Madden heard arguments on a motion by the city to quash a lawsuit by the family of Eric Garner, who gasped 11 times, "I can't breathe," as he was choked to death by NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo on July 17, 2014. The suit, brought by Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, his sister, Alicia Flagg Garner, and six other allies, demands an inquiry to investigate the events surrounding the stop, arrest, and death of Garner. Gwen Carr spoke at the news conference after the hearing.
It's been 6 years since my son was murdered on New York streets. He said, "I can't breathe," 11 times. And there were so many officers who was involved in this. We had officers, the first officer who choked him to death, which was Pantaleo. Yes, he was fired. That was just a little justice. That was just a step in the right direction. But there were so many other officers. There was officers who lied on official reports. D'Amico, Justin D'Amico, said my son had 10,000 cigarettes on a person. No. He said there was no force used. We know that there was force used. My son is dead. And there was the supervising officer, Adonis, who looked the other way as my son's life was being choked out of him. None of these officers should be on the force. And we even had others who just looked the other way when my son was being murdered. They are all a danger to New York City, and they shouldn't be on the NYPD police department. We have to get rid of dangerous officers.
Former Police Commissioner James O'Neill and Fire Department Commissioner Daniel Negro are named as respondents in the suit. The Garner family has long held that Pantaleo's superiors at the scene, including Sergeant Kizzy Adonis and EMTs at the scene, should have interceded. Ex-cop Pantaleo's May 2019 departmental trial ended with his firing. Sergeant Adonis lost 20 vacation days in a separate proceeding. One of the city legal legal department's arguments for dismissal of the suit revolves around wording in the city charter they interpret as giving the police commissioner the power, but not the duty, to discipline officers. Again, Gwen Carr.
I think that was a very irresponsible position to take, because if an officer is out here and he's supposed to be patrolling the streets and protecting the citizens, and for them not to discipline him if there is wrongdoing, I mean, how does that sound? That means it's giving them the okay to do whatever they want and they're not going to be disciplined. I really don't know what to take on that accusation that he made. It was like a slap in the face. What is he talking about?
Gwen Carr is the mother of Eric Garner. Attorney Gideon Oliver is co-counsel for the family. He says the city wants Garner's family to file Freedom of Information Law or FOIL requests for the information they have, including 62 categories of information they've already filed for. But Oliver adds, in the case of Marley Graham, pursued and killed by NYPD officer Richard Haste in 2012, the city hasn't released the most important documents. Oliver says they need a special hearing before a judge to get everything out in the open.
We ended the first round of oral argument on was the city's lawyer, you know, basically saying that the petitioner should have done their homework before filing the lawsuit. And of course they did. And that's one of the points that co-counsel made today. For years, petitioners have been doing their homework. And one of the points that I tried to make about the Freedom of Information Law request, which is a kitchen sink request, 62 plus categories of records that we filed on behalf of some of the petitioners and are pursuing along with co-counsel from the Legal Aid Society's COP Accountability Project. That was part of doing their homework. Filing the FOIL was part of doing their homework. And the city's agency's responses to those FOIL requests have been to drag their heels, to trickle out just a few documents, and otherwise to keep kicking the response dates down the road, which is not what the FOIL requires. And it's also, not what transparency and accountability or even a perfunctory commitment to those things would require. So the city's lawyers' representations that what we're looking for from the court in this inquiry we're going to get from the FOIL request are totally divorced from the reality.
Gideon Oliver is co-counsel with attorney Alvin Bragg. The case is not on a timeline. Eventually, Justice Joan Madden will issue a written decision on the city's motion to dismiss. Community members are calling for an investigation into the death of Ashley Moore, a black trans woman whose body was found in April at a Newark Y. She apparently fell from a window, though little is known. Activists and family members are calling for an investigation. WBAI's John Riley has this report.
Ashley Moore, a 26-year-old black transgender woman, was found dead outside of her Newark YMCA residence on April 1st, 2020. Starlet Carbon, a nurse and the woman's mother, discussed the police indifference to the case, the medical examiner's failure to deliver the autopsy report, and the efforts of the Newark LGBTQ Center and herself to push through a proper investigation of the death. Repeated calls by the family regarding the medical examiner's office autopsy report were ignored. Also, 4 months after the death, no death certificate has yet been issued. In an interview on Out FM to be aired Tuesday, August 11th at 8 p.m., I asked Ashley's mother, Starlet, and Beatrice Simpkins of the Newark LGBT Center about the contradictory theories and facts put forward by the Newark Police Department detective, who variously asserted that Ashley may have been hit by a car or fell from a great height. The detective failed to explain the ligatures or rope-like marks on Ashley's legs, the bruises on her swollen and twisted neck, and the rectal bleeding. I asked why the Newark Police Department hasn't considered this case to be a possible homicide case. Beatrice Simpkins responds.
That's what makes this all very curious. Did say, I believe, Starla, they did tell you that they actually went into her room because she lived in the Y.
Yes, she paid rent.
They took nothing. They didn't take her cell phones. They didn't take her clothing, her personal items. Everything was left there. As if it was just another dead black trans person in the street, and we're just we're satisfied with that.
Clean it up.
We're not going to put any more effort into it. We're just going to accept it as that.
Ashley Moore's mother, Starlet Carbon, was asked about police speculation that Ashley fell.
That was the conversation between myself and Detective Bullock. So initially, in April, Detective Bullock stated that the doctor thinks it was your daughter was possibly hit by a car. So after speaking with Beatrice, the conversation then became, well, this is what the detective said to me over the phone. According to the police report, Ashley's injuries are consistent with someone who fell from a great height. According to the police report I read, and I already told you what I read, ligature marks on the legs, neck grossly swollen and disfigured, not to mention rectal bleeding. Mm. That is also in the police report. Now, Ashley lived on the third floor of the YMCA, and in the police report, the witness that they interviewed, the police interview, stated that they saw Ashley running down the stairs and out the door, which was supposed to be locked, but for some reason wasn't locked. So I was confused as to why the police department were trying to lead me into a belief that my child jumped or fell from some great height, where on the actual police report where they interviewed the person said the exact opposite of what he was telling me over the phone.
That was Starlet Carbon discussing the failures of the Newark Police Department and Medical Examiner's Office to adequately do their public duty to investigate suspicious deaths and inform families of deaths of their loved ones. The family has set up a GoFundMe site to pay for an attorney to press for a full investigation. For more information, go to justiceforashleymoore.org or go to outfm.org. Both sites have the GoFundMe link. This is John Riley for OutFM, and it's a new day.
And that's some of the news for Tuesday, August 11th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry and John Riley for the WBAI News from New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Thanks for joining us.